My name is Norman Barth, and this is another in the series of global issues. And tonight we'll be talking about Africa, a troubled continent. You know, I'm really pleased to have evening sessions because I know what to say. I can say good evening or afternoon. A friend of mine experienced something that has made me to be very leery of having morning sessions. He attended a liturgical retreat. And every morning the retreat leader would begin the day, "Good morning." And everybody in the group, you know, replied, "Good morning." And this went on day and day. And by Wednesday, you know, he said, "Good morning." And someone way in the back of the room replied, "Good evening." To which the leader replied, "Someone chanted evening." That's how it is. So I'm happy to be here and be able to say good evening.
You see, it sure was a short day, though.
It was. And we're going to talk, by the way, a couple of people asked about where they could get this book, Our Common Future, and it's available in our bookstore, along with another book by Lester Brown on 1989, The World in 1989. First of all, I want to see how many people have been to Africa. Okay. Well, so I'm going to have to watch what I say.
Yes.
First of all. And those who haven't been to Africa, what does the thought conjure up in your mind when you, what do you think about when you think about Africa? Anybody can just shout them out.
Contrast.
Pretty
hair of
desert.
Giant, yeah.
Desert.
Forestation.
Poverty.
Savages with spears and loincloths.
Yeah.
Fast growing Lutheran churches.
Yeah, well, see.
Rhythm and art.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Black people.
Black people.
Very big.
Very big, yeah.
Greatest section of increasing church attendance in the world, right?
Well, that's true, isn't it? Many people say more like pygmies, huh? Forests, jungles, huh?
Uneducated,
yeah.
Music
a lot of those. What was that?
Music and harmony.
Music and harmony, yeah. Yes, if you read Ernest Hemingway's books, you know that it can be that. It can be spectacular. And there was a movie not too long ago, what was it, on Africa?
Out of Africa.
And you saw some of the very beautiful scenery. That is true about part of Africa, but not all of Africa. But most Americans think of lions. I remember my own mother, when she came to visit us in South Africa, you know, didn't realize that there were cities like Johannesburg or Harare or other cities on the continent, but expected, you know, that there were literally lions. Well, lions are as... But most Africans haven't seen a lion, quite honestly. Most Africans haven't seen a lion. And the heat of Africa is another thing that's quite famous. And it isn't very warm. Believe me, when you're up 10,000 feet and you're in Ethiopia, you're not warm at all. And the jungle is almost as uncommon as snow is in Southern California. And pygmies are almost extinct for decades now. And there are only a few pygmies left in Africa. And while Ernest Hemingway indicated how beautiful Africa could be, if you've read Something of Value by Robert Rourke, you know how savage it can be and how unsophisticated it can be. After World War II, a journalist writing for the Los Angeles Times described Africa as, quote, "just a bunch of real estate," end of quote. But Africa can't be pushed aside that easily in the 1980s or the 1990s or at any time in the future. Africa, quite honestly, is going to influence the events that take place in Moscow as well as in Washington, D.C. Some of you have already seen one slide that I'm going to throw on the screen here, showing that Africa is four times the size of continental United States. Square miles, whereas the United States is about 3 million square miles, continental U.S. And as I said, if you put the Horn of Africa on St. Louis, Dakar over here will be in the Hawaiian Islands. And if you put Tunisia up here in New York, Cape Agulhas in South Africa will be around Santiago, Chile. Can you imagine? And yet, we also will talk about Africa. And we talk about Africa as a complete entity, as though it's one country like the United States or Canada. And yet, it's an interesting thing how rapidly Africa has expanded politically. When I was going to the University of Minnesota way back in the Middle Ages, I took a minor in African history and then went on to Georgetown to do further work in Africa, because I was sure in my own mind that Africa would be a continent with which we had to reckon during my lifetime. John Gunther, in his book Inside Africa, when he wrote that in 1953, there wasn't a single political entity in Africa that was independent except for Ethiopia, Liberia, and South Africa. How many countries are in Africa today? Anybody got an idea? Well, I'm not sure myself, quite honestly, but I'll put up a map that shows some of them. And there are either, don't quote me, I haven't researched this recently, there are either 53 or 54 African countries, huh? Today, and I'm talking about Africa south of the Sahara. And you have to do that because north of the Sahara, these countries along the Mediterranean are really quite different than those south of the Sahara. South of the Sahara, you have Black Africa. Up in the north, you have Muslim, Berber Africa, Mediterranean Africa. Well, this is quite a continent, you see. And as I said, it's a sophisticated continent and yet a savage continent. You could have lunch with someone in the major cities such as Lagos or Dakar or Nairobi, Lusaka, who would sit there opposite you with a three-piece suit, PhD from Oxford, and wondered who won the Super Bowl. And all you need to do, and we're talking about contraries here, ride out a couple of hours in a Land Rover, and you could be sitting with an illiterate group of villagers and just eating a goat or a sheep that was just slaughtered that day. Huh? And people who literally would be still hunting with bow and arrow, and who thought all white people were either doctors or missionaries. Punctuality is not a trait of an African. I remember we used to invite people, we'll say for dinner at 7 o'clock, and expect them maybe to arrive either before or as late as 8:30. And because many people didn't keep diaries that noted that you were going to go to my house on next Thursday, you had to be sure that you sent them an invitation not too long in advance so they would forget, but not too soon or immediate before the event, or otherwise they would already have another invitation. I remember I was in Tanzania up in Arusha, which is in the northern part of Tanzania, and I was flying to Dar es Salaam on Air Tanzania, talking about punctuality. And the flight was supposed to leave at 9:30 that night. It left at 10 minutes after 9. And when I asked the person at the counter, how come you're leaving early? What if somebody else comes? Everybody who's bought a ticket is here, we may as well leave. And we did. And if anybody came late, they missed that plane. Another thing that you find in Africa that speaking concisely is not a regional trait. Africans like to be, in my experience has been, accommodating. Is this the road to any place? To Niger? Yep, sure is. It might be that road, but they don't want to disappoint you. So they say, that's the road. And so you have to say, which road is the road to Niger? Or Niamey, or wherever you're going. How many miles is it to Niamey? Oh, 20, 10, 5? That's not the question you ask. You ask, how long does it take? In Lesotho, the speed that you could maintain on the roads in Lesotho was about 3.5 miles an hour. So if somebody says, hey, it's just 20 miles down the road, you say, hey, I'll be there in 30 minutes. It could take you a long time. And another thing you find out about Africa is that every hour you fly in the air in a small aircraft, we'll say, means a day's travel if you went by car. Because of the isolation and the remoteness of some of our projects, we have to take private planes. For example, up here in northern Kenya, we had a project that was supported 2.5 hours out of Nairobi. It would have taken me 2.5 days to drive it by car. So Africa, while it has the modern availability of aircraft, if you are reduced to driving by land, you're going to find that you're going to need a lot of time. You ask how long it takes, you don't ask how far it is. And Africa is an interesting place, a continent of contrasts. How do you explain, for example, an Idi Amin who walks into a conference of the OAU, the Organization of African Union, with 2 six-shooters strapped to his hips, a cowboy Western Texas Stetson hat on his head, and he's applauded by his peers, his contemporaries, having just the previous week slaughtered hundreds of thousands of Ugandans? How do you explain a president of Tanzania who in his spare time translates Shakespeare into Swahili while he has more political prisoners in jail than the Republic of South Africa has? How do you explain a pint-sized president of Gabon who eliminates the word pygmy from his vocabulary and the vocabulary of his people and wears platform shoes, and builds a $2 million residence in the Beverly Hills for his daughter while the citizens of his country are destitute. And he himself drives around Libreville in a gold-plated Cadillac followed by a silver-plated ambulance afterwards. But for every Idi Amin, I suggest that you also have a president of Senegal, Leopold Senghor, who in 1962 was a candidate for the Nobel Literature Prize, For every corrupt leader stashing away millions, if not billions, I'm happy to say there are men and women who are prepared to work for $60 a month teaching children in high school and grade schools, knowing that it is upon these children that the future of this great continent will hang. Why is Africa so important and yet so troubled? Well, the reasons for its interest and importance to us and to the rest of the world are many. Certainly politically, it's because they hold a third of the votes in the United Nations. By far, they have the largest reserve of untapped natural resources left in the world. And they're desirable by both the East and the West. Its land could feed everybody in Africa plus everybody in Western Europe. AID about 3 years ago said that Africa could increase its yields 130 times if properly farmed. It's also important because, although it's less now, it seems, with Mr. Gorbachev, it's also a potential battleground for East-West problems and superpowers. Ethiopia is a case in point. Angola used to be. Ghana was at one time. But these things seem to be diminishing. It also has human resources which are as underdeveloped as its natural resources. 470 million people live in Africa, and half of those are under 15 years of age. Can you think of what that means? Is it any wonder that the church is expanding in Africa? Well, not really, if for no other reason than just the numerical aspect, that when you have that many people, something is bound to happen, just from sheer numbers. Take a look at this one quickly, and we'll use this a little later this coming week when we talk about population. Here are the more developed regions of the world. This is the profile of their population groups, from age 0 up to 75 years and plus. The checker is 1975. The white is the year 2000. Look at that, almost straight up and down. Take a look at the less developed countries down below. And here you have, you see, millions of people, male and female. And look what's happening. And look at that age spread down here. There aren't many people up here at 75. Not when you know that in Niger, for example, life expectancy is about 43 years of age. And that's not uncommon, whereas up here, our life expectancy in the developed areas, and as you know here, it's 74 to 76 years, depending on what gender you happen to be. So Africa, with its 470 million people, who will eventually demand, I think, freedom from disease, poverty, and repression, what's going to happen on that continent? What are some of the calamities that are striking this continent? Well, I think first of all, and not necessarily in the order priority, is economic paralyzation. Economic actually collapsing. A friend of mine was ambassador to Mauritania. You see the sign there, it says Mauritania up in Western Africa? And Ed wrote to me when he found out I had left the Foreign Service, and he said, Norm, if you want to help Mauritania, you better hurry. Because it is being inundated by the desert. The OAU, in fact, the Organization of African Unity, states that by the year 2000, Mauritania won't be an economic state. There'll be people there, but it'll have no economic base upon which to provide them with any kind of services. Years ago, the capital of Mauritania, Nouakchott, was miles from the desert, 20, 30, 40 miles. Today, the desert is literally blowing down Main Street. And LWF, Lutheran World Federation from Geneva, for example, is, along with support from LWR, trying to build what they call a green belt around Nouakchott with trees to try and stem the ever-blowing Sahara Desert into that country. Second thing is cities. It's happening here too, of course. The movement to the city, urbanization. But in Africa, it's killing the continent. Why? Because you see, and one of the reasons is the fact that many countries, to make food cheap for the urban masses, because I got to take care of these people who are right around the presidential palace, I don't have to worry about the guy way out there in the hills, reduce the purchasing, the floor for grains that are being produced out in the countryside, to keep the people in the city happy. And so the farmer says, the heck with this. I'm going to go to the city and get cheap bread. Throws down his tools, you know, gets rid of his plow horse or cattle and leaves. And then all he does is accentuate, of course, the problem. In 1953, there were three cities in Africa that had a 500,000 people population. Today, there are over 29, and many of them have as many as, well, Lagos, for example, has got over almost 2 million, 1.5. And even Soweto, which we celebrated yesterday, has got over 1 million people. And so, urbanization is a problem. Another one is, of course, you saw, population. And yet I don't know an African, or very few of them. Whereas we might think population is a real problem, I know few Africans who would agree with us. Why should they? When you've got, for example, Niger, the 18th largest country in the world, here it is, 18th largest country in the world with a population of around 6 million. Why should they worry? Take Botswana down there at the bottom, next to South Africa. Maybe got a couple of million at the most. They don't see any problem. And yet, Africa has Kenya is the highest birth rate in the world, around 4%. And if you know the rule of 72, you take 72 and divide by 4, and you'll see that it'll come up, what's that? 18 years, it'll double. You can do that with the interest you get from your bank account too. You get 10% interest, money will double in 7.2 years. I'd like to tell you give you three pictures of Africa. One is a woman that I met in the slums of Nairobi. And that's another thing about urbanization. People move and there's no place for them to move. No housing. No housing, no water, no sewage, no garbage collection, no medical service, no education, no school. Anyhow, I met this woman. Her name was Mary Ngiri. And I talked to her as she was making supper. And she put her body over the pot that she was stirring because it was raining just a little bit. And I asked her about herself. She was 40 years old. She had 13 children. And she didn't know where most of them were. The younger ones were in the city of Nairobi, panhandling, trying to make some money. Her husband daily walked into Nairobi to get a job as a day laborer. And if he was lucky, he came home with some money. But most of the time, he didn't. Her two children, her two girls, ages 15 and 16, were prostitutes. And that's how they earned their keep and helped their mother and father. The older children had already left. And she was pleased about that. In the same town of Nairobi, a colleague of mine visited a man whose father said, Francis, his name was Francis Thuol, Francis, unless you want to work, break your back like you see these men in the street, you better make something of yourself. You better go to school. And my friend tells me that Francis Thuol had an office in a high skyscraper in Nairobi. And he, along with four other men in Nairobi, were the stock exchange, if you will. And they ran the stock exchange. Every morning they got together in a different individual, one of these five men, and decided what the price of various stocks were going to be. There was a man who decided he was going to get out of the trap that he found himself in. And then the third one was a Maasai warrior. The Maasai people live in southern Kenya and northern Tanzania. And he was out herding cattle in his red ochred cloth. And his father said, you know, you can't raise cattle the rest of your life. You've got to improve yourself. And so this guy named Gidson, I guess it was Gidson Mardadi, M-A-R-D-A-D-I, decided he was going to open up a little shop. And I saw that little shop. It was smaller, I suppose, than this area here. Without any electricity. In there, he sold pharmaceuticals for cattle, some flour, some matches, a little salt. Most of the day, he sat there, not selling much of anything, but making enough. Three different people. One caught in the web of life in Africa. One who said, I'm not going to sit here, and made himself an entrepreneur. And the other one, a shopkeeper. And I think it reflects the vicissitude of a continent where every life and every way is in transition. I'd like to take you to a little piece of history. You know, many of us, North Americans, you know, say that Africa is a backward country. Why don't they do something? Why aren't they like us? Well, you know, you have to know history of Africa to really appreciate the situation. First of all, according to Mary Leakey, man started over here in Africa, in Ethiopia or in Kenya, 2.5 million years ago, that the first Homo sapiens, as defined by anthropologists, appeared. And that's tragedy, isn't it? That if things did start there, where are they today? But they had some great, great kingdoms. Kingdom of Ghana, the Kingdom of Mali, the Songhai Kingdom, which probably involved both of them. You've heard of Timbuktu, and everybody thinks it's some mystical place, but it's there in Mali, on the Niger River. And Timbuktu in 1250 had a larger library than the University of Paris or the University of London. The King of Mali could put more men into the field than King Arthur or any of the Louis. And I can't recall the story exactly because I read it too many years ago. But when he went to Saudi Arabia to make his hajira, his trip to Jeddah, I think it took some 30 camels to carry the gold that he brought along to present to the king and the people of the Muslim faith there in Saudi Arabia. In 500 AD, they were smelting iron in Nigeria. And the country of Benin, which is the small little thing right here next to Nigeria, in 1496, exchanged ambassadors with Portugal. What went wrong? Why is it that these kingdoms died and are unknown of largely? Well, I think the prime reason that I always have thought of is two in number. One, they had no written language. And the only written language in Africa at that time was in Ethiopia. And the second reason is, had they had a written language, they didn't have any paper to write it down on. And even if they had paper, as you know, paper is biodegradable. And under the situations that you have in Africa, probably would have, you know, disappeared over the ages. And the third reason is that unlike Europeans, they never acquired a surplus that they could convert into cash, and then with that cash go out and do some research or do some other type of thing that would improve their society. And then came the Europeans. And the Europeans did nothing to improve the life of the Africans. They came to either improve themselves economically or to advance their God among the people. And so they came and they began dividing up Africa any way that pleased them politically. Down here in Namibia, for example, you got the Caprivi Strip. Isn't that an unusual situation? And who was Caprivi? He was the son-in-law of Bismarck in Germany. He was an Italian, and his father-in-law made him the foreign minister of Germany. What was that Caprivi Strip put in there for? Well, you see, they also owned Tanzania, or Tanganyika, as it was known. And what they were trying to do, of course, is to tie those two together. Speaking of Tanzania, and that's not a very good likeness of Tanzania, something like that. Have you ever wondered, you see, at one time, that border went straight, right down to the ocean. Anybody know why it isn't straight today? Queen Elizabeth wanted to give her nephew a birthday gift. And they owned Kenya, the British. And so she gave him the highest mountain in Germany, Kilimanjaro. And they just took that border and changed it. And Kilimanjaro, some 29,000 feet, sits today in Tanzania rather than where it used to be. And so when you get people dividing up the country willy-nilly on the basis of a birthday gift, you know very well that ethnic groups were divided, huh? Here's a husband and wife, they're both the same team. They just drew the line right here. Didn't matter. Even though they were cousins or, you know, brothers or sisters, you cut it. And so there are only three countries in Africa that I know of that are populated by one tribe. Swaziland, Lesotho, and Somalia. And so what do you have? What do you have? Here we are. If we were in Africa, we would each be maybe a tribe unto ourselves. The European powers Balkanized Africa. And as a result, one tribe was pitted against another, even though they were in the same country. And tribalism today is one of the big things in Africa that is suppressing Africa's development. There are over 2,000 tribes in Africa. Zaire, this great country that used to be called the Congo. That's an interesting story too. The Congo, which was the personal property of the Belgian king, Leopold. And that's why it was called, the capital was called Leopoldville. And it was his own kind of reserve. And only much later did Belgium give up that country, and today it is Zaire. But it's got, for example, over 200 languages. There are over 2,500 languages in Africa. And from way over here where you have Djibouti speaking French, the next closest colony also speaking French is way out here. And so how do you get along? Well, our friend in Tanzania, whose name escapes me for the moment, tried to bring in Swahili as the lingua franca. And indeed, Swahili is the lingua franca of much of East Africa. And over here you have French and the native language of Hausa. Tribalism. And tribalism is, I suppose, much further developed than anything we have here in what we would call nepotism. The president of Kenya called tribalism as the cancer of Africa. Yet it determines who gets a job, who goes to the university, who gets promoted, who is accepted one place or another. I was in Zimbabwe, and a young lad I knew wanted to get a job in a hotel as a clerk, spoke good English, And I said to him when he told me he didn't get the job, I said, why not? You have all the qualifications. He said, yeah. He said, you know, the owner of the hotel is a Shona, and I'm a Montebelli. He said, I knew as soon as I heard he was a Shona that I wouldn't get the job. And he didn't. We here, you know, we're concerned about nepotism, which, by the way, as we all know, is a relative thing. But but you see, and Tom Roach, who was LWR's man in Nairobi. There they have two tribes that are primary. They got 10 tribes, but two of them are the Kikuyu and the Lao. He told me an interesting story. He had served as a Peace Corps volunteer in India, but this was his first assignment for LWR in Africa. And he had three servants, a gardener, a guard, and a cook. And he hired a Kikuyu as cook, and a Lao as a guard, and a Lao as the gardener. And he said the only way he described it, his first 3 months were sheer hell, because everything was falling apart. His guard accused the cook of trying to poison him. And the gardener accused the cook of trying to bewitch him. And so he fired the two Lao, because the cook was the better of the three, and went out and hired two Kikuyu. And peace settled upon his whole household. You see, because tribalism is such an important factor in Africa. And it hasn't diminished either. It hasn't diminished because there's very little intermarriage. Somebody from this tribe isn't going to marry someone over there. First of all, you don't do that. It's disloyal to the family, to the clan, to the tribe. And secondly, someone from over here isn't going to get that far, given the transportation. So you stay within your own grouping. For you see, the family is your welfare state, it's your social security, it's the police who take care of you. And to leave your family, to leave your tribe, is like taking a devout Catholic and excommunicating them. They just don't do it. A good example is the little country here that once was owned by Belgium, called Burundi and Rwanda. Highest density population, some 400 and some people per square mile. And the people who live there are the Hutu and the Tutsi. Well, Wa is merely the sign for more than one. Okay. Tutsi. The Tutsi make up 15% of the population. These make up some 84% of the population. And then there's a small group of pygmies who make up one. And it's the Watutsi, these giant 6 foot some people with largely long feathers, which make them even look bigger, who probably came down from Nairobi, from Kenya, who control the 85% Hutu and the pygmies. And have you have there in 1964 when I was serving in Brussels? Well, it actually was 1972 after I left Brussels. The Watutsis, because they feared the Hutu, went out and killed everyone that had an education or a government job. And one man said it was worse than the slaughter of the Jews in Warsaw. That was in Burundi. In Rwanda, they did the same thing, only in reverse. And the Hutu killed over 100,000 Tutsis, Watutsi. Bertrand Russell at the time said it was the most horrible and systematic human massacre we have had occasion to witness since the extermination of the Jews by the Nazis. And what you have here is apartheid in dark tones. And the unfortunate thing about it is, to my knowledge, the Christian church and the missionaries raised not a voice in opposition to that slaughter of the Tutsis by the Hutu, and vice versa. Going back to population, Zambia, for example, the size of California has only 5.3 million people. 30 people per square mile is the average population density, which is the same as in Russia or the United States. So you can see there are a lot of problems in this country. I better stop. I can go further, but there may be some questions. There are probably all kinds of them, I hope.
Yeah, isn't one of the things that held Africa back the fact that their religion, as far as they believe the ancestor spirits would stay in the same place, and so that prohibited them from traveling?
Maybe in Madagascar, and I wish our friends from Madagascar were here. Can you respond that? Were you in Madagascar? Can you talk about that?
You know, they can't leave Madagascar anyway.
So. Yeah, that's another thing. I try to remember that Madagascar is part of Africa, and too many people don't even consider it. They look here and they forget Madagascar. What about that problem in Madagascar, where they have all kinds of, I've never been there, friends of mine have, build all kinds of monuments, do they, and things like, can you respond to that at all?
Yeah, the quoted statistic is in the southern half of the island, 80% of personal wealth is spent on graves and tombs. I have no way of verifying that. People that live in grass huts, you know, spend all their resources on cement tombs.
Yeah.
I'm in Dubuque, Iowa right now.
Right.
A missionary that spent his career in Tanzania, Howard Olson, says that the traditional animism really prepared the way for Christianity and makes it so smooth because they're a spiritual people and they can make the transition very quickly. The longtime missionaries in Madagascar disagree with that sharply, so maybe there's a difference in traditional religion between the mainland and Madagascar, where they say the bondage to ancestors is not a step toward Christianity, but something we free people up from. So there's a difference there.
Yeah, I was reading a book on African myths a while ago, and African religions. They talk about the near dead and the farther, the distant dead. But we do that in a way. My mother died in 1985. And I still think of my mother. I still think of my grandparents. They're a little further back. I can't really go beyond grandma and grandpa. But in Africa, you see, they will remember these people for a lot longer time. We do that. It's not ancestor worship in our part, but we do remember them. And I'm not sure that it really is a real strong factor. It may be. And Madagascar is one of the unusual places where they build these monuments. And it's interesting that you should say, well, they live in grass houses. And that makes me think of, for example, this king of Ghana that I told you about. I'm going to tell you a story. Ghana, the Ashanti tribe, Ashanti, their authority is based on, and I lost that crime, on a stool, a golden stool. It's just got two pieces. Maybe I can find it. Yeah, here it is. Looks like this. Yes. And this was in a golden stool of the Ashanti people. And he heard some British anthropologists were coming. And so in order to save that stool, he put it up in the rafters of his grass house. And one night, it fell down and killed him. And the moral of the story is people who live in grass houses shouldn't steal thrones. Just a true story. What other comments?
Is anyone projecting, other than in Zaire, what the impact of AIDS is going to be on the African peoples?
In Africa, it's known as SLIMS.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the Africans, I might say, are very, very unhappy, and maybe they have a right to be, because Western medical people say that AIDS started here in Burundi or someplace, huh? And they contest that. They think it's another slap by the West to downgrade Africa. On the road between Dar es Salaam and up through here into Uganda, it's just, I'm told by friends both in Kenya as well as in Tanzania, that the prostitution rate is so high that AIDS has got just about to 75% of the people. I don't know. If we project it on the United States basis, we know that'll be almost 100% in some places. But we have to be sure when we start accusing the Africans as being the, you know, center for this disease. I don't think we really know, do we? Any of you medical people, do we know for sure where it came from? Many of them say it came from the green monkey disease, which is well known in that part of the world, but I don't know.
One thing we found in the Cameroon, where that may be impeding progress, is the fear of ever getting more than a neighbor or somebody else in your tribe. Becoming more wealthy, having more land, producing better crops, whatever, because then the fear is that some sorcerer will curse your land or throw lightning at you. And it's against the law in the Cameroons to throw lightning. Mm. They really believe that somebody can virtue. So they're loath to have even the agronomists who come in help them produce more grain on their land, plant more cassava, get more manioc flour than somebody else, because that will cause jealousy and envy. So how do you progress?
Education.
Yeah.
I think. I remember when I was in Lesotho. Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Well, you mentioned that this was a high, the great population, the density of the population. And then you also mentioned that the percentage of AIDS. The population isn't going to grow very much if the AIDS can take over either.
No.
And it looks like an impossible situation about to cure itself through its own, through disease.
You may well be right. And this is what happens when many people project things on the current statistics and they don't take into consideration such a thing as that. My sister touches on an interesting point, and that is witch doctors. When I was in Lesotho, I once wrote a report to the Department of State, what I called a hap meeting. Remember back in the late 60s and early 70s, happenings occurred on colleges and universities. And I wrote a report on a happening in Lesotho, Lesotho style. And it was where they literally skinned the man alive. Why? Undoubtedly because somebody wanted his piece of property. And a witch doctor had determined that this man had done something to the local chief's family and that he should be killed. And once he was killed, then the chief could divide his property, because in much of Africa, and I don't know how it is in Madagascar, much of Africa, the land is owned and held by the chief for the people of the country. And one of the problems you have with South Africa down here is that when the Boers came in and they asked the Lesotho chiefs or the Basotho chiefs, can I have this piece of land? They said, sure. Because in the African mind, they give you the land, but it's not yours forever. It really belongs to the African people, to the people of the tribe. But when the Boer farmer got that land, he then went to armed mentality and said, well, that land is now mine. And that's a factor has caused a lot of problems. Let me just say, talking about South Africa, last night or a couple of nights ago, we spoke about South Africa and its role. I think South Africa, if it resolves its problems, can be a very important factor in the future of Africa. Even now, I know for a fact that almost nightly, 747s filled with South African meat go into Lusaka. When the Nigerians were having problems with birds, who did they call in to help? South African ornithologists. And much of what Black Africa says about South Africa is for outward consumption. And they depend to a great degree. So the point is I'm making, maybe poorly, is that South Africa, with its technical knowledge, its expertise, its efficiency, I think if they resolve those issues, can be a very, very important factor in at least the southern six, the southern cone as it's known, in resolving a lot of these problems in the economy of that area. Because Lusaka and Zambia has got all kinds of copper. Zimbabwe will do all right by itself, I think. Mozambique has also a lot of wealth. Surely Namibia has got all kinds of wealth. When I was in Namibia, you couldn't bend over to tie your shoe because in some parts, the diamonds lie right on the ground. And they think that if you're bending over, you're picking up something of value. And they will strip search you as you go out of that particular area. And that's one reason why the South Africans are mining the wealth of Namibia 7 days a week, 24 hours a day.
I have a comment.
Where?
Up here.
Yeah.
I guess I was kind of saddened by parts of your talk, particularly when you were kind of talking about, you know, Africa in ways that I guess I've heard about it growing up as kind of a target for other countries' political exploitation or exploitation of natural resources or exploitation of people resources. And I don't want to look at a continent that way anymore. I want to look at it as a compassionate human being, looking at other human beings who are suffering and dying. I don't know much politically. I'm not very up on things. But I do know that of the 53 countries in Africa, that there is not a country there that has an infant mortality rate of under 50. That means that out of 1,000 kids born each year, there are between 50 and 250 kids that die before their first birthday.
Yeah.
And I don't want to look at that as some big, just blob of a continent. I want to see that as human beings who are suffering and who are dying and who are being exploited not by only tribalism, but by our racism, our supporting the racism in some of those countries. And I would like to know what, you know, our role is in supporting these people and giving them the opportunity to do what's best for them as they see it.
Yeah. That's one reason why Lutheran War Relief spends between 60 and 65% of its resources in Africa. Because it is a continent that needs our compassion and our love. And that's, you know, I have lived in Africa, I've loved Africa, I've studied Africa, and Africa means a lot to me. And what I said about colonialism and such things is to give you some of the problems created by Western Europe, by North America, in Africa, and that their problems are also internal in terms of tribalism. But I try to indicate that, you know, one of the reasons is because of silly things like that. And with no consideration that a certain tribe lives here and we shouldn't just draw a mark on the map and change it. No, you're right. Africa deserves, and that's one thing that I hope can come out of this evening, is an understanding of Africa and its problems, and the fact that it needs the assistance of all of us. Surely, I wouldn't want to do anything else. I've invested too much of my life and my time concerned about Africa.
Are you going to talk about the projects, the major projects of World Relief in Africa?
I do plan to do that, and that's a chat I plan right now to do on Friday evening of next week. Of this week, or whatever week we need.
I just know I've never been to Africa, and I don't know a lot about it, but I do know that last year I was fortunate to work in a tutorial center with three graduate students, and one was from Cameroon, and one was from Nigeria, and one was from Kenya. And they're all in their late 20s and early 30s.